بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salam, hello, peace to you all. Welcome to Office Hours. We are back. I'm Adnan Hussein, and it has been a while since our last meeting of these regular, usually weekly office hour chats and sessions. I've been traveling a lot during the month of December, dealing with some health issues upon my return, but we are back because there is just so much to discuss and to understand about what's going on in the world, and in particular, what's been happening in Iran. And before I introduce my topic and guest today, I just want to remind you all to please like the stream so that it gets on to other people's feeds, share it on your social media so other people can join this very important and timely discussion. It's streaming also on not only on YouTube, but also on X, so you can retweet the stream if you're watching there. And of course, subscribe to the channel so that you're apprised of upcoming programs, which include the return of the Struggle Session. Struggle Session 7 is coming this Sunday at its usual time, more or less. It might be 3:30 rather than 3, but watch for postings this Sunday, January 18th. And I'll be having Nina Farnia, Lara Shihai, and possibly a third mystery guest. You know, I don't want to promise anything, but it would be very exciting if they can attend. But in any case, if it's just me, Nina, and Lara, that's going to be a great discussion with two fantastic panelists. So join us then. And also, you can support this program with my gratitude and also the gratitude of all those who benefit from the programs and the live streams but can't afford to contribute financially during these very difficult economic conditions. And you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/Adnan Hussein, or make a one-time contribution through buymeacoffee.com/Adnan Hussein. But in any case, without further ado, joining me today is a returning guest for a vital and timely conversation on Iran, society under sanctions, my friend and colleague, Professor David Yagubian of Cal State San Bernardino. And this is his third appearance on the show. Dave, it's so great to see you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Adnan. Great to be here. Looking forward to our discussion.
Well, absolutely. And of course, we've been discussing because, you know, we talked, I think it was in August after the 12-day war, about rumors and predictions that had come up about an imminent attack on Iran that were expected maybe early in the fall. And Trita Parsi, who, you know, was the voice kind of making these public kind of predictions about imminent attack. And, you know, partly because the end of the 12-day war had been left without a kind of decisive resolution other than, you know, the fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran was not about to be destroyed by, you know, attempts to bring the country down, and that it could also retaliate and cause a great deal of damage. So we had started having discussions to discuss the situation then in the fall, because there were expectations that it would happen either imminently at that point, or certainly, according to Trita, by December. Okay. And we ourselves, you know, we're in Tehran, in Iran, in December. And I thought it would be better, of course, there's so much to talk about what's been happening the last 3 weeks, and we will. But I thought it's better in some ways to put things into some context. Both of us are historians, and also this recent history is important to cover. And because we were there and we had impressions that might help normalize Iran as a society while also talking about the challenges and the difficulties under sanctions, that I wanted to kind of start there and just say, you know, how would you characterize, you know, the situation over the course of the fall, both politically, economically, socially, and, you know, then let's talk about just, you know, our trip and what it was like being there and, you know, how regular people were experiencing the situation.
I think we discussed this a little bit in August as this was beginning to take shape. But in the wake of the 12-day war, there was really an outpouring of Iranian nationalism reflected through gatherings, speeches, art, statuary, music, which especially in the wake of the 12-day war, is sort of omnipresent throughout Tehran. And that's one of the things that on our recent trip there that we got to experience. So the having survived the war, having demonstrated the unity of the society through the process of, I think, realizing that, and it was a little nuanced, but realizing that a majority of the society really came together during that period, with the allowances for personal interpretation of the hijab laws, which, you know, we experienced there and saw on our trip, where I'd say roughly about 50% of women are still wearing hijab. There seemed to be, and this is from my take, having been there in May just before the war, and then through my observations and conversations with Iranians, both in Iran and outside of Iran, over the summer, that there really was, if you will, an increased relaxation in the relationship between the public and the state. I hope that makes sense, but again, having survived the war, having demonstrated unity, and that unity being demonstrated not only by the traditional, typical supporters of the government, but also, for example, you know, videos that went wild on social media of women without hijab, stating very adamantly their support for the government and their anger over the murders of nuclear scientists, over members of the security apparatus, that this enabled the government in turn to embrace the more diverse, elements of Iranian society relative to the standard supporters who of course will always come out and who can always be counted on. And so in this context, things seemed to be, and this was my interpretation going in December and on our trip, I feel that this was sustained. Things seemed to be, at least socially, very relaxed. Like, in fact, I don't know that I, in my 25 years of regular travel to Iran annually, had experienced such a level of societal relaxation. And I hope that that's not too vague of an explanation for viewers. But in terms of relaxation, just with the music, with the change in the dress that is very, very stark to behold, especially after 25 years of regular travel there, things seem to be very calm. And in terms of my general observations of sort of retail and commerce, things seemed to be booming. Now, with that said, despite the fact you've got music in the streets, Iranians of all walks of life seemingly going about their day, like, enjoying their urban existence. And I'll let you weigh in on your take, having just experienced that and I'd say participated in it. But one thing that is sort of ever present, irrespective of kind of the social vibe, if you will, is the constant complaints, which are fully legitimate, about particularly inflation. As we might get into details regarding how sanctions impact societies, there are many other elements to sanctions that hurt people, especially like the middle and lower class. But the inflation is something that impacts all Iranians. So, whether you are lower class, lower middle class, all the way up, inflation is something that impacts all Iranians, and that is something that you constantly hear complaints complaints regarding. Now, when we showed up in December, I was genuinely shocked at the level of inflation, because when I was there in May, and later on, I might go into a sort of history of how the currency has devolved, but rather the level of inflation. But it was about 850,000 reals to the dollar when I was there in May. This was shocking to me. This, you know, just 850,000. And again, I could go through, you know, the rapidity with which over the last few years it has just, you know, increasingly doubled the level of inflation. But at 850,000, I was shocked. When we were there in, just in December, we got a sort of black market rate of about 1.25 million to the dollar. I was so shocked by that myself that, if you remember, I was asking as many questions as I could from different people that we were hanging out with, meeting with, you know, about this inflation and how this was impacting them. You know, with Milad, asking, you know, for business owners, like, how do you deal with this mid-month when you suddenly have this, you know, radical inflation? So I guess my point here is that whereas things in the wake of the 12-day war seemed to be very calm in Tehran, based on my, you know, basically south to central Tehran zone that I hang out in, the inflation is again ever present, and was something that we heard, of course, people talking about and complaining about. But during our short trip of just a little bit over a week, of course, nothing specifically related to the inflation had emerged or come to a head. There had recently been a strike in the South Pars gas field of gas workers that was, you know, unequivocally against foreign intrusion, foreign support, but that was nevertheless expressing the needs of the South Pars gas workers for better conditions. And it wasn't just in terms of pay. It was you know, an array of different issues. So my point is that labor complaints and strikes had been going on in the wake of the 12-day war. Of course, very careful to state the sort of support for the government along with criticism of certain policies. So yes, indeed. Also, we were aware that not everyone was content, certainly with their economic circumstances. But as far as I could tell, there was no sign of brewing protest. Nothing kind of under the surface bubbling that one could sense was about to, you know, blow or pop or emerge. Again, even though I tend to kind of annoy people with my repeated questions about, you know, how the sanctions are affecting the inflation, how they deal with it as, say, retirees or retired veterans of you know, workers at hotels or you know, middle class business owners, but I didn't get much, and so relative again to the shocking level of inflation that had occurred just since May, over 6 months, again from 850,000 to 1.25 million. Clearly, this had an impact on the protests that immediately emerged. That is, after our trip, we had the, I believe it was on December 28th, I could be wrong about that, but the Tehran shopkeepers strike, which was a peaceful protest, which was something that the government didn't even respond to. There weren't really security there within the frames, within the scene. But it's at this point that I believe that the plan for hybrid war regime change was implemented, and say stemming from those initial peaceful, legal shopkeeper strike, we had the outpouring of street violence, the burning of mosques, the burning of ambulances and fire engines, the murder of civilians, as well as security personnel. So I was, you know, watching alternative media along with everyone else, seeing how it unfolded. And I'll just say the violence, the intensity of these protests, that is, you know, after the very calm protest of the shopkeepers, was relative to what we were experiencing in Tehran, and my sort of expectations or understanding of the level of, say, economic malaise and how that was impacting people. I found this to be just completely inordinate and not like within balance relative to what we saw and experienced. So I guess I'll say again, and I'm happy to elaborate on this. I fully understand and can talk about individuals and their personal experiences and their specific complaints, why Iranians would take to the street to protest the economic circumstances, even knowing that a majority of the economic pain is being caused by sanctions. The role of the government is also critical as sanctions impact various levels and elements of the society. So there are certainly reasons why Iranians would take to the streets to express their discontent, say, with the Pezeshkian administration's approach to inflation and to the sanctions, but. This is in, I guess to be an understatement, say in very stark contrast to what we saw with people getting out the machetes and the sort of like medieval clubs and AK-47s and beginning to, you know, burn their cities.
Yeah, yeah. We'll have to definitely talk about, you know, the metamorphosis of the initial economic protest by merchants, bazaari class, and the spreading of those to, you know, much more dramatic and confrontational and violent kind of forms. But, you know, just coming back to the situation, you know, before the outbreak of, you know, protests, and just, you know, talking about the brief time that we were there in December, right ahead of the start of these, because there's so many, you know, portrayals and imaginings of, you know, what the situation is like, it's important to kind of emphasize that for me, as somebody who, you know, studies the region, but had never visited Iran before, this was my first visit to Iran. It was a very surprising kind of visit, because even, you know, what I would have expected as somebody who, you know, doesn't necessarily buy a lot of the Western propaganda and characterizations, but not having visited, of course, one had an impression that, you know, it was surprising for me, for example, that I saw one turbaned mullah with robes in the street during my week-long visit in the streets of Tehran. Okay, we did visit, of course, shrines, and there were a couple of people who were clearly from what one would call the mullah or clerical class. But it's not like it's very present socially in the capital city, for example. Maybe if you're in Qom, which is where all of the seminaries that train, you know, most of the seminaries that train this religious class there, of course, there would be a larger kind of more public presence in the population. But it's not like, you know, the rule by mullahs is something that you experience as a direct social kind of experience. As you mentioned, during at least this period, and I don't know how it compares with what you witnessed in May and in the previous visit, very, you know, a very substantial portion of women were, you know, not wearing hijab, and there really wasn't a lot of like social tension around it, I think is the important point, that even though these laws hadn't been themselves repealed, it was very publicly kind of acknowledged and understood that in the wake of adjustments because of popular protest in earlier years, like the Women Life Freedom era, you know, movement that had, you know, taken place just a few years earlier, that the government was no longer going to be so committed to trying to enforce these, and nor were other social groupings in society, you know, like there weren't vigilantes trying to, you know, put pressure on people. That just seems to be something that is no longer going to necessarily be a necessary characteristic of social life under the Islamic Republic at this point or at this stage. There was not a lot of police presence in general. Like, I hardly ever saw a policeman, and certainly they weren't, you know, if you go to lots of other countries in the region, you will see, you know, armed with, like, you know, machine guns, you know, police presences in all of the major kind of central squares where a lot of traffic. Yeah, it didn't really seem like that. And these are things that are not what I would have expected, even as somebody who was, you know, familiar with, you know, the history of Iran and, you know, critical and suspicious of the kinds of impressions that are given in Western media that contribute to a sense that or assumption that people are constantly under kind of direct repressive. There is, of course, obviously, you know, every society we're seeing isn't as committed to, you know, democratic values, but, you know, protest is tolerated there. So that's another thing that you were mentioning about some of the gas workers in the southwestern part of the country, which is where the oil and gas industries are most located, that there has been labor organizing, certain kinds of strikes or protests and demands being made, and that these have to be done very carefully in the atmosphere of, you know, to distinguish between, you know, economic and social grievances and protests on behalf of those in order to prevent them from being, you know, manipulated by or conservative forces using, you know, the fact that they are under pressure from the U.S. and Israel to delegitimize. Like, it has to be done very kind of consciously and carefully, but it is happening, and it had been happening, which is why the initial economic strike and closure of the businesses in the Grand Bazaar of Tehran was actually, you know, maybe people, you know, people entrusted with the economic management of the society were probably not pleased that people were upset and protesting, but they, you know, the leader, president all said, okay, these are genuine grievances, you know, that are legitimate and that it's okay to protest. And in fact, actually, that we will try to do something, you know, about it as it spread and became, you know, more widespread that people were expressing the economic discontent. We saw that there were responses, you know, by the government. In fact, actually, it's probably worth talking a little bit about some of the initial economic adjustments were made before we start talking about what's happened subsequently. So my understanding, and perhaps you can help me understand a little bit more, is that the initial protests started with a very rapid change. So you mentioned that it was like 1.25 million to a dollar, rial to a dollar, the exchange rate. That obviously isn't the official rate. That's really what it was like, you know, when you actually, you know, exchange outside of the banks and so on. But that it was like suddenly 1.4, I think, on like the 28th. And this is what, you know, really is a dramatic increase percentage wise. There had been over the previous 6-8 months, you know, from 850 to 1.2. But then this was a big jump. And it really, you know, caused a response, you know, by its merchants. But that the government basically, you know, removed some of the people who were, you know, in various, you know, ministries for the economy. They put in place, it seems, some kind of like direct subsidy program rather than it being subsidized for a consumer. So maybe like a ration system. I'm not sure. I haven't seen any details exactly, but somebody described it who's in Iran, described it as like a kind of basic, you know, UBI type sort of thing for certain kinds of expenses. But that, you know, there were some, you know, kinds of adjustments as a result. And this is exactly, you know, what you would see is that protests, mass mobilizations have, in fact, in the past caused change. Like they've either led to reformist governments or abandoning enforcement of the hijab laws, or in this case, you know, government responses to change some of the economic policies, giving tax relief for merchants for a year from certain, like a tax holiday from certain things. As I said, replacing economic officials and so on. So, you know, how would you analyze those? And I don't know if you have any information about what some of these economic changes have been, even as the government has said that they can't necessarily solve all of the economic problems, given, you know, the sanctions and the fact that, you know, they don't have the full range of tools that they could, you know, use really to change the situation.
Yeah, you know, I don't really want to use the analogy, but I guess I'm about to state it. But rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic in an economy under this level of sanctions, primary, secondary, extraterritorial, despite the fact that Iran still has allies that it can trade with, makes it extremely difficult for the government to stave off ongoing inflation of the currency. And so, as you mentioned, the Pezeshkian came out, fired a few ministers, actually replaced them with ones that had been previously fired for similar reasons, right? Again, in terms of rearranging chairs. But this issue of the subsidies links right back into the issue of inflation, because the government has been, since the early 1980s, providing subsidies to elements of the society, especially like the lower class, lower middle class, for certain items, goods, as well as certain industries. Okay, and like, so for example, like industries, just saw before we came on today a picture of some beautifully, you know, hot off the press, literally truck tires, and that the Iranian government is going to give Iranian truck drivers free tires. And I think it was some extra gas allowance. And so this is one form of subsidy for truckers. The government was very proud that Iranian truckers didn't heed the call from Reza Pahlavi to stop trucking. Right. So here's a handout for the truckers. You guys are doing good work. Here's tires. Here's gas. This might help the truckers. It will in the short term. This does not enable the government to effectively deal with the inflation when it essentially, it doesn't work exactly like this, but it is printing money to cover these subsidies. So subsidies are one of the issues that has maligned the rial since the mid 1980s when, and we could go into that history, but when the United States put Iran on the list of states that support terrorism and put Iran on the list, took Iraq off the list at the same time so that it could provide dual use technology to the Iraqis. And this is when the inflation really started to grow much more rapidly, right around 1984, 1985. So government subsidies since that time have been provided so that the, say, most vulnerable elements of the society don't suffer inordinately through sanctions. But again, what is inordinate? I'll just say, you know, Mike Pompeo once said, if Iranians want to eat, they'll listen to my 12-point plan. It's not about eating. Iranians are going to eat. No one is going to starve or go hungry in the country. But what you can eat to sustain yourself and the cost of that, and the cost of that relative to other things that you need in your life. This makes life for ordinary Iranians. And I could give examples of, you know, different types of middle-class Iranians in different situations. This just makes it extremely difficult for everyone. So, the subsidies, I'm just saying that this isn't, it's not like Pezeshkian sitting on a big pile of money and he can decide, you know, should we give this to the military industrial complex or should we help out, you know, needy Iranians? The funds just simply aren't there. Furthermore, and I'll just mention this in this context, when Iran needs to buy stuff from abroad, and even though it has a very robust, resilient economy where it makes whatever it can domestically, including those truck tires, it still needs to use, if you will, hard currency to purchase those items, unless it has some sort of currency swap deal. And those are sort of new in the making. So to the extent that the government does have funds, it's not just a matter of, well, you know, where do we want to apply them? There are very limited funds for a great host of needs from the military and defense all the way down to, you know, subsidizing bread for poor Iranians. So I understand the necessity for the government to say, hey, you know, we're gonna do these things and we've got a new idea. But think about it. Iran has been under these sanctions, well, really for about 40 years, but the intensive sanctions and maximum pressure since 2018, they've been trying a lot of things. They've been shuffling a lot of cards and shells. And at a certain point, the inflation is just going to be inevitable. If you continue to print money, you continue to provide subsidies. One other thing I'll just throw in here, anytime Iran makes a new bill, millions, if not billions of them flood in from the borders in the form of counterfeit bills. This is just one of the ways that Iran's enemies seek to further destabilize the rial. So this is also just another thing that the Iranian government has to deal with. And so as there's new inflation and people don't want to have to carry around giant stacks of bills, they'll print new bills. And within days, counterfeit bills are noted and found and pulled out of circulation by banks. But this is one other thing that also feeds into inflation. So, and again, I'm happy to talk about, you know, other elements of that, but just subsidies can be a temporary salve for some people, because, okay, the truckers, you know, they can breathe a slight sigh of relief for, you know, a few weeks maybe because they got some new tires and they got some gas. But overall, when they're facing, you know, what in just, as you said, just another, what would that be? I'm really bad on math, another almost 20% rise over just a few weeks on top of already just shocking inflation. It's understandable that Iranians took to the street to protest. Again, the peaceful protest regarding economic circumstances is completely different than the violence that we saw unfold after especially, like, say, the third day.
Right. You know, I mean, that's probably where we should turn to. But I just did want to say one last thing about sanctions is that, you know, typically we've, you know, there have been a lot of studies now about, you know, the consequences of long-term unilateral and, let's admit it, illegal. These are illegal sanctions that are imposed. You know, the devastating consequences that they have on, you know, overall health, the hollowing out of a middle class. Those are the people, the middle class and the more vulnerable are the ones who are, you know, most subject to the devastating consequences and effects. Whereas, you know, black marketeers and, you know, elites in the society manage to survive. And in fact, there is a whole economy that develops that you could call a corrupt, you know, economy that develops around circumventing sanctions, you know, control over rare, you know, goods and smuggling and so on. And so it does create, its own kind of social and economic problems of enhancing inequality. It doesn't, actually really tend to really have big consequences for the political or economic elites who actually can not only survive those circumstances well, but often even profit,
If I may, Adnan, let me, I just want to jump in there, because if we aren't able to come back to it, I just want to say that this is the one grievance that I've heard from many different people, all like, I guess you could say, in and around the middle class. But understanding that the country is under maximum pressure, knowing that it's not easy for anyone, the knowledge, and this is I'm speaking for the people who have told me about this, that it unfortunately in the Islamic Republic of Iran, despite the rhetoric of the voice of the voiceless and the mostazafin, the oppressed, it's still oftentimes in business has to do with who you know, who's your daddy, who you're connected to. And it's not just I'm an Iranian citizen and I'm or even, I'm a Persian Shia Muslim and, this is my country. And we have a merit-based republic where, we have an even playing field. What I have heard from patriotic Iranians, who the last thing they want is to see their government overthrown or come under the control of the United States, but that, hey, man, I'm a patriot and I'm going to the mat for this country, and I won't use the expletives, but they will curse and say they're giving the contracts to their friends, they're giving the contracts to their kids. It's still who you know, and this runs from Tehran, the megalopolis, down to smaller cities and towns. And I would say it's especially in the smaller cities and towns where people are aware of who got the contract instead of them, or who got the shipment of whatever some bulk commodity from India at a certain price that they weren't able to get, that therefore completely undercut them. And damn it, that's not fair. So this, if viewers are wondering, well, if people understand that it's the sanctions that lead to the inflation, where would some of this anger towards the establishment come from? And this is where, at least in my experience in talking to people, I've had some conversation with people like really pissed off trying to explain this to me, like, basically, dude, this whole voice of the voiceless, that's for press TV. That's and sure, they'll show somebody's economic protest in like Bolivia. But when we are pissed off about the fact that it's still who you know, who you're connected to, not how devout you are as a Muslim, having nothing to do with that, just being connected. And this for many is extremely frustrating. So now, is Iran any different than many other societies in that regard? Certainly not. But under maximum pressure sanctions, when everyone's supposed to be taking one for the team and dealing with this and hunkering down, and to your point, one can see that segments of the society are actually profiting from this. And, the government doesn't stop people. Hey, if you can afford a new Mercedes and you can import it, go ahead. You remember, man, when we were in a cab, do you remember when we saw that brand new Mercedes being delivered to someone on a flatbed? So this is the kind of thing that I know real Iranian patriots get super pissed off about. And so I just wanted to throw that in there. It's not just the inflation. Maybe they can even understand the inflation and what I just said regarding, okay, subsidies are sort of, you're chasing your tail with that. But when this system that proclaims itself to be a meritocracy and to be rooted in Islamic values seems to them to be very similar to former regimes from Zamana past, if you will, from a past era, this is really angering. And so I would just say clearly, not everyone who took to the streets over the last couple of weeks was a paid Mossad informant, no matter what Mike Pompeo might lead you to believe by way of his tweets. But In terms of those engaging in just obscene violence, you know, smashing in human beings' faces and beheadings, I think we could probably take Mike Pompeo and Jerusalem Post's word that those were indeed, Mossad paid, led, trained elements. But just wanted to make sure that viewers understood that. I'm cognizant of the reasons why many Iranians would still, despite their patriotism, their support for the government, protest in hopes that the government can do even better or can do much better than it has been doing, irrespective of the clear challenges that it faces relative to maximum pressure sanctions.
Right. And, we only, did that context to, say that you have to look at the larger structural framework, but that structural framework is in fact actually designed to create those destabilizing conditions. I mean, the whole theory of sanctions is to create economic dislocation and misery so that the idea is people will be so miserable and upset with their government that they will rise up. I mean, that is the reason why it's done. It isn't done to punish the sort of like, elite. It is to try and create the conditions, of dissatisfaction and the legitimate experience, grievances that come from the legitimate experience of people who are suffering, but to have that undermine, the government and to be able to create, the conditions for exactly the sorts of protests that, then might bring down, and they don't mind, just as they didn't in Iraq, they don't mind, subjecting the population as a whole to such difficulty. I mean, wasn't it Madeleine Albright who said that, it was documented in a UN report that 500,000 Iraqi children had died over the course of a decade of unilateral U.S. sanctions, upon Iraq, presumably to punish the, kind of Saddam Hussein and the elite, those who were governing the society. But in fact, it led to devastating health, outcomes and effects that led to, excess deaths, prenatal, children, 500,000. She said, well, it's worth it, So they're not, concerned about how the people of Iran may be suffering under the sanctions. In fact, it's actually part of the theory that in order to achieve by other means than direct invasion or assault, to actually try and create a change of undermining the government and forcing a change in its policies, so that it cannot defend its own sovereignty, is actually subject the population to this kind of misery, so that they will rebel and replace the government. So that's kind of what leads us, to the moment where once the protest started, even though the government acknowledged, legitimacy of the economic grievances, these did turn, as you were pointing out, into a much more kind of, they didn't remain peaceful for very long, right? And so we have to sort of talk about that and, what is the explanation and understanding? One way of looking at it, of course, is to see it as a continuation through other means of the 12-day war. And that is, in fact, actually, sanctions are meant to be. So even the manipulation, if that was, in fact, what caused the sudden dramatic depreciation of the rial, over the course of about a couple of days where it lost maybe 15-20% of its value that led to the initial, economic strike of business people, is that, that it is meant to, lead to sort of chaos in the society. But if you look at it as maybe a kind of continuation of the war by other means, which is what sanctions are. In fact, there's a great book called Sanctions as War. And we did actually on guerrilla history. There are a number of case studies, including the study of sanctions in Iran, but a whole bunch of other countries. If you realize that, about 20-30% of the world's population are living under some form of unilateral U.S. imperial sanctions.
I thought it was over 50, actually, but
well, they keep expanding, but they're losing some of their effect and consequence as, you know, new mechanisms are developed, you know, other financial mechanisms. But in any case, the point is that, so how did these turn so violent, and you know, how were they being used to try and justify, you know, kind of military strike or military intervention? You know, how did they become such violent attacks on public infrastructure, banks, mosques, public transport, buses, medical services, and ambulances were attacked and destroyed. And of course, a great number of police and other law enforcement people have been killed, as well as, you know, some number also of those who were carrying out these violent attacks. So what, you know, how do you understand? And it seems like it lasted mainly for like 2-3 days at an intense sort of level. But that when the government suspended internet service and also used various new technologies and techniques for identifying, you know, these mobile Starlink satellite, you know, internet servers and so on, that there was then, you know, a kind of petering out of the, you know, violent protests. So what does this sort of tell us about, you know, what was going on and how these economic, you know, discontent that was being expressed turned into, you know, something much more disruptive and destructive?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I definitely don't think that we can separate the 12-day war and the continued economic pressure that the United States has been placing on Iran from this uprising. Although, of course, there or, you know, whatever you want to call it, our current circumstances that could, you know, potentially lead to another war. The thing that really struck me about this round, this effort, and again, I without the cues and without the statements of Mike Pompeo and you know, Israeli security, I would have already been aware that they were behind the flood of weapons, certainly the guns to fight against Iranian security forces. So their involvement, their support, basically in the wake of the 12-day war in something like this would be a given. However, and whether or not this has to do with the inability for them to actually shape and guide things on the ground the way that they would want. And again, I just say in the wake of the unsuccessful 12-day war and with the wrap-up of many of their agents and spies during that time, perhaps this was just the best that they could do. But the point that I want to make is I was struck that I didn't see really any elements of or many elements of the traditional sort of color revolution approach whereby even, you know, color revolution. Well, what was the color? Who is the individual that we're following here? Some might have said it just by default became Reza Pahlavi. In terms of a message, in terms of a chant, in terms of an ask, this was essentially turned straight into just mass violence against not only, and this will help me make the point, not only the security services, say police stations, but fire engines and ambulances and mosques and apartment buildings and businesses. We saw banks. We saw stores, just people's common stores. There was a guy the next day out there crying, saying, "Hey, like, I understand things are difficult, but who's going to help me with my store now? It's all burned down." So interpreted this, and I've been listening to, you know, many talking heads myself over the last few days, trying to put things together, and it seems as though if there was a guided effort this time, not only to engage in violence against security services, it was geared more towards a civil war and the dissolution of Iran as a sovereign nation, more than it was just simply regime change. And so in this context, we can see Reza Pahlavi as sort of the useful idiot for Trump, who already came out and said, hey, you know, I don't know if the guy's got enough support within the country, but simply to enable the rioters to push the security situation over the edge to the point where, regional groups such as, you know, in Balochistan, in Kurdistan, potentially up in Azerbaijan, down in Khuzestan, would similarly engage in mass violence. And thus you could see the country essentially split up into component parts, which is exactly what the United States and Israel would want at this point. So I guess just again, in sum, it's just I was struck by the lack of a guided, concerted, uniform message, one that would resonate with Iranians, one that would bring millions of people out into the streets like we saw on Monday, when millions of people actually came into the streets of Tehran to demonstrate their support for the Islamic Republic. Had the rioters or initial protesters utilized, say, phrases, songs, targets that appealed to masses of Iranians, we might have seen a different outcome. But you are not going to appeal to a majority of Iranian citizens, and I will make this generalization, by burning mosques and Husseinias. That is just certainly, and Ali Alizadeh was on with Max Blumenthal yesterday. Excellent conversation. And he himself, he was kind of admitting, yeah, you know, there's probably a good 10, 20% of Iranians who are very, you know, secular, maybe atheist, hate Islam. Yeah, and some of those people would come out and maybe gleefully burn down a mosque or a Husseinia, but this is not going to appeal to the majority of Iranian society, for which acts are horrific and shocking. So this round, in very stark contrast, of course, to 2022, which kind of spilled over a little bit in 2023, but women, life, freedom, whatever you want to call it. Of course, the ask from Women, Life, Freedom was much more clear, and one could interpret that in some ways that movement was successful in obtaining some of its ask. The ask here is just mass violence, death to members of the Iranian government and its security services, and essentially chaos for the Islamic Republic of Iran and civil war. So that's what really struck me, and certainly other commentators who have been speaking over the last few days about this. Just the I don't know if it was the expectation that just this level of obscene violence would somehow appeal to more and more Iranians, but I really think that this worked against bringing out greater support for the rioters, and irrespective of the fact that the internet was taken down, that Starlink was shut down, I just believe that the overall approach, both through this level of heinous violence, as well through the targets of the fires of the rioters, worked against the possibility that the movement would continue to grow in strength. And so this for the Iranian government, I mean, with the Monday rallies in support, and it wasn't just in Tehran where there were millions of people. I mean, in every city where we saw footage of the violent protesters, you know, killing Basiji, smashing people with street signs and with shovels, there were tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Iranians in the streets of these smaller cities. And so the approach of I guess the supporters of this round of violence, which I would place it firmly, you know, in the hands of the United States and Israel, was wildly unsuccessful. And I won't belabor the point because perhaps it's obvious, but Reza Pahlavi just is not an appealing figure to your average Iranian. There may be, I don't know, 15, 20%. You got royalists in Iran still. I have heard people say, and I love the Shah and he is my Shah. I've heard that from a guy. And I was like, oh, cool, man. Great. You know, like knock yourself out. That's the kind of guy who might have taken to the streets this time. And like, you know, Reza Pahlavi is going to come and like save us and make everything great again, like it was in the memes, you know, everything before the Iranian revolution. So, you know, those people exist, but the vast majority of Iranians, he's just kind of a weird joke. Like the idea that this guy that's never worked a day in his life, the silver spoon kid who is just it, so I would say it's not that a mass of Iranians are like, oh, like, he is a Zionist and he is in the hands of, you know, he's just not relevant. This is from a bygone era in terms of like a viable political figure to lead the country. It's not Reza Pahlavi. And then furthermore, you've got, you know, Maryam Rajavi, the MEK. They've got even, I mean, far less even, like, you know, Pahlavi's got infinitely more of a chance than the MEK, right? Kind of interesting to see them like duking it out in the streets of Los Angeles, but I won't go there. That is the royalists and the MEK. This again, just kind of echoing my point that in terms of classic kind of color revolution tactics, hybrid war, this one seemed geared towards really just fragmentation of Iran, internal strife and civil war, potentially to enable the United States to legitimate a military strike during, you know, government responses to such uprisings.
Right. I mean, you know, it is important to remember, I mean, historically speaking, that it was a Republican revolution, you know, that did take place, you know, I mean, regardless of whether there are divisions about, you know, the Islamic character of the state that ended up being established under the constitution that replaced, you know, the Pahlavi state. I mean, it was a Republican revolution and that was pretty popular, you know, so there doesn't seem to be, you know, a genuine appetite and he doesn't have like on the ground, you know, organizing capacity or support. And in fact, actually, that's actually a very important and interesting point is that, you know, the demands were very unclear, as you were pointing out, like the first demands of the economically distressed, you know, I mean, they're very clear. We want this inflation to mm-hmm. stop. We need, you know, some kind of regulation so that the currency doesn't go into complete free fall and then we can't afford basic necessities. I mean, that's a kind of clear, you know, popular demand that would resonate with a lot of people. But once it became just this kind of destructive, you know, the regime must fall kind of thing, or it's illegitimate. I mean, what we're discovering is that while there is like a portion of the population that would regard the Islamic Republic as anathema to how they want to see the country, is that by and large, people do regard the government as legitimate. There was a Republican revolution. There isn't, in fact, actually a very clear kind of alternative that anybody could crystallize around or has been actually put forward in any of these. Because as you're pointing out, they're not actually perhaps based on a popular organized opposition developing in response to genuine kind of material and social criticisms. They are instead, you know, in some ways inspired by groups that either want to break away, you know, or, you know, break apart, you know, the country. And what it reminds me very much of, and which is why I'm so surprised, how many people haven't recognized the pattern, I mean, is that this just reminds me so much of like what we saw a year ago, you know, in Syria. You know, it's like, I mean, how many times do you have to see these attempts, you know, to try and overthrow any sovereign nation in the Middle East that, rejects, you know, a settler colonial expansionist aggressive regime, you know, in Israel, or wants to be able to follow its own path of sovereign, you know, economic and social and foreign policies, that they immediately become enemies of the United States and of Israel. And, you know, we saw this with Syria. We've seen it with Iraq more than 20 years ago. We saw it with Libya. You know, like it's a little astonishing to me how people refuse to see that there is a kind of pattern, which doesn't mean that there isn't discontent. Of course, we know, you know, and in fact, actually look at any country. Is any government in the world really that popular? I mean, in the West, you know, in, you know, lots of other parts of the world, I mean, this is an endemic problem, because what we have is, on a global level, we have, you know, the consequences of imperial capitalism that creates a huge divide, a huge wealth inequality. You know, I mean, the United States is the government popular? No, there's all kinds of discontent. That in itself doesn't delegitimize a government, right? Like, that's, I think, the assumption that a lot of people are making, is that because there is some corruption or mismanagement, and there is inability to, you know, in a society under sanctions, to actually provide, you know, economic, you know, sustenance for the people on a, you know, kind of level that people would, you know, be satisfied with, that doesn't itself, you know, delegitimize the system. What it means is that there are critiques, and that there are social and economic struggles to be waged. And we haven't seen that those themselves have been anathematized. They may not be, you know, appreciated by officials of the government, but, you know, on the other hand, they have been acknowledged as real and genuine concerns. There's a big difference between what we witnessed, you know, in the later stages of these violent sort of protests, and, you know, those others, as we've been saying. And it's really just a question, you know, really of sovereignty, that is unacceptable to Western hegemony. And so that's very hard to see why it is that it isn't clearer in some ways that there is a pattern that this is falling, you know, into. But in any case, it seems that even Trump, you know, could understand. I mean, it's always hard to predict, but even he could understand that Pahlavi, you know, is not really a viable political option. You know, he sort of made some distance. But what's interesting is all of these threats and the military threats. And earlier in the week, you know, we had already planned to have this on, you know, this Friday office hours. It looked like, you know, earlier in the week that there might be a military attack. I know that there was a kind of national security meeting chaired by, you know, I think it's Vice President Vance, you know, about policy and the options. And we've been seeing some very interesting kind of responses, you know, in U.S. circles, in Israeli circles, about, you know, pulling back in some ways from an attack or an intervention. And in some ways, it seems that the kind of violence, and even announcing, you know, that Mossad agents are, you know, running wild, was meant in some ways to try and polarize and make a more extreme government response in order to justify the, you know, military, you know, some kind of military intervention, and so on. So I'm wondering, how do you see the, because you actually in August, you know, we started this conversation with, you know, what had been predictions being circulated late in the summer about an imminent military attack upon Iran. And you came out very clearly, you know, at that point saying you didn't think there would be, and that the outcomes and consequences of the 12-day war suggested that there was enough of a deterrent effect that it wouldn't be contemplatable for a while. And it's in part actually your confidence in that, that, you know, made me, you know, willing to go in December. I said, okay, just, I hope Dave is right. I think
we might be right.
Exactly. You know, I mean, at the time, I also said, but the counterpoint was that there are some ideological groups that are extreme enough that they are willing just to cause so chaos and destruction, and they don't, you know, kind of mind, you know, in some ways there isn't a kind of apocalyptic sort of imagination, you know, at work here in this supremacist sort of kind of perspective. So, you know, it was unclear whether there might be people who were not willing to be rational actors in the balance of deterrence, but because of ideological reasons, you know, might sow kind of chaos in the region through military attack or intervention. But at this point, maybe it seems like your predictions and your analysis, you know, are they holding up? Do you think that this is genuinely a pullback because they actually, you know, made an attempt here to sponsor and foment internal kind of chaos that would allow for intervention to be successful? But now, after the big counter kind of protests, the suspension of the internet, and the, you know, fact that these, you know, there may continue to be, you know, protests about the economic kind of questions, but it seems that the destruction of mosques and the attacks on public institutions and the killing, you know, you know, citizens and police and so on, that seems to have subsided more or less the last 4 or 5 days. So what's your analysis of the situation now and the prospects and possibilities of, you know, some kind of military strike, or what is the U.S. and Israeli kind of approach going to be?
I think irrespective of anything that is going on the ground in Iran or that has gone on the ground in Iran, if the United States and Israel together believed that they could kinetically attack Iran and achieve their goals of either regime change or just spinning the country into total chaos, they would do that in a hot second. And so my prediction after the 12-day war that there would not be this coming strike that many, including Trita, were saying, oh, it's going to be in August, or, you know, now it's going to be, if you remember, it was going to be in autumn. And then Alistair Crook was like, oh, we got a weather window, you know, they're going to have to do it now. And I was kind of calling BS on all those simply because I didn't see the relative American and Israeli strength to successfully pull that off in light of what happened during the 12-day war. So ultimately, you know, Trita was like, oh, well, it might happen in December or in early in the year. I guess we'll find out if that prediction of his was accurate. But relative to where we're at right this minute in terms of, you know, how am I feeling about this? Well, I'll be honest, going on at 2 o'clock, at least my time, Pacific time, on a Friday, I was honestly, and still am, I haven't checked my Telegram, so concerned that if Trump was going to kick something off, this is when he would do it relative to stock markets and how he likes to you know, where his priorities and concerns are. So, you know, right now, I don't have some solid adamant take that I'm going to argue here that, you know, like I was arguing in August, that no, absolutely, they're not going to attack again. This is, you know, just forget about it. And this is my calculation. Applying the logic that I was applying when I spoke to you and when there was really great feedback from the audience, and, like, you know, Benji was warning me, hey, you know, don't ever apply logic or reason to these freaks, to these warmongers. But basically, with my understanding of the capacity of the Iranian military to continue to pummel Israel and to destroy any and all American facilities in the Persian Gulf region, that stuff that wasn't even broken out during the 12-day war, I would still argue that it would be essentially suicidal, and I'm saying in terms of its imperial standing, suicidal for the United States to go to war with the Islamic Republic of Iran now, or even in a week, or even in 2 weeks. Go ahead and bring the aircraft carriers up. Those are basically large floating coffins these days with the march of military technology. But based on the last 6 months of complete insanity from the Trump administration, including its domestic policies, which, you know, I won't even go there. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. The the idea that the empire will go to war in Iran, irrespective of the risk of it turning into a essentially the quagmire that Trump would like to avoid, making Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria just like a joke, not even comparable. I no longer have that confidence that somewhere in the back room there is someone who's saying, yeah, Lindsay, yes, we know, but we can't do it because the math just doesn't work. We won't win. We're going to actually lose. I don't know who has Trump's ear at any given minute, what advice he is being given. And of course, what the assessment is of Zionist and American military planners relative to what they think they would like to accomplish in Iran. I'll just put this out there. This idea that, they don't have a plan for after, and they don't have even, as I was saying, a good color revolution set up going. So what about just indiscriminately bombing infrastructure and continuing to just make life miserable for Iranians? I'm just saying, I would not have hypothesized that. I would not have predicted this before. But at this stage today, Friday, January 16, 2026, I really just don't know. So I would just say, to provide an answer, based on my reasoning from the late June of 2026 up until now, I don't believe that the United States will make this mistake and actually attack Iran in a way that would lead to an actual open exchange. Maybe develop another tit for tat thing. I could see that. Iran would buy another 6 months if they could just do another, we'll hit this and you'll hit that, and no one will die, and Trump can proclaim victory and everybody can proclaim victory. They would do that if the option was presented, I believe, in my interpretation. But Iran absolutely will not accept being struck by the United States or Israel without massive retaliation. And Iran has made this clear. This could potentially be why, if the stories that we've read are true, that the Israelis and the Arab states said, "Hey, cool your heels." But I'm not believing any of that. I don't think any of your viewers are going to be believing any of that. It really just comes down to whether the empire believes that through the application of kinetic force against the Islamic Republic of Iran, it can get its way. And get its way in the short term, because Trump likes things kind of on the short term. So this is where we're at. I'm flipping Telegram as fast as I can with everybody else, trying to read the tea leaves to determine. And it just comes with so many other points of analysis. Who's got a NOTAM? Who's got, what do the radars say? Where are tankers at this minute? Where are aircraft carriers? All of these dynamics, it's just impossible to tell. But based on my logic and reasoning over the last few years, it's not feasible for the United States to go to war with Iran in the American style of war that it wages. I'll just leave it at that. But just that, and I don't see preparations for that American style of war being brought to bear even right now. So moving up an aircraft carrier doesn't do it. So it's just very, very difficult to tell. In the context of the Trump administration, which is just to say it's unpredictable is a vast understatement.
Yeah, certainly at the very least, and I've seen articles characterizing that basically Trump is buying time. If there is an intention to make a strike or an attack, it certainly isn't going to be to protect, the so-called, peaceful protests, which of course haven't been since, really January 8th, where they turned much more, violent. It's not going to be for that, even if that's the, kind of framework that he's used. It may be because it takes a long time to actually redeploy and position, you know, forces. And so this is an important and interesting point to kind of observe, that the Venezuela buildup in the Caribbean, you know, that had been taking place over the course of the whole fall means that the U.S. military, despite the fact that it has 800 bases around the world, is not in a position either because of armaments or because of forces, because of like, you know, the you know, the naval capacity, et cetera, to really mount a very significant and intense, you know, military attack on Iran. It could maybe do something, you know, that would be, you know, like what they did when they destroyed all of Iran's nuclear facilities, you know, which was the kind of mantra that had to be maintained to create a way of de-escalating and ending the military and rescuing Israel really from the consequences of its failed attempt to, you know, overthrow Iran's government. You know, so as a result, you know, there are some kinds of limits and limitations. And even if, you know, they plan to do something, you know, later on, it would take time. This isn't the, you know, aren't the current circumstances. And it's important to kind of recognize that, you know, just as, you know, in some ways, I would argue that the Iraq War and the U.S. imperial, embroilment in Afghanistan and Iraq and those major commitments helped, in fact, in some ways allow the spread of the Bolivarian revolution and the so-called pink tide in Latin and South America, because the U.S. was really occupied and stretched, and it allowed other places for anti-imperialist sovereignty and development to take place in a different way. That likewise, you know, this you know, build up around Venezuela means that it is very hard to contemplate the U.S. maintaining, you know, the kinetic capabilities on all fronts everywhere, and that the empire is being stretched. So that's at least, you know, perhaps hopeful and confirms the kind of analysis that you've been making. But it is quite noteworthy the way in which, I mean, I don't know what you think about the reports that came out of Israeli, or at least were sourced as Israeli concerns, as well as like Gulf and neighboring countries' concerns, you know, that it wasn't the opportune time and moment to do it. And I think it's basically as a response to the fact that, you know, the couple of weeks of protests hadn't destabilized the government to the extent that it would be, you know, possible to really, you know, make a successful attack that would have political consequences. I mean, you might be able to bomb some targets, but not actually affect the political sorts of change.
Mm-hmm. I mean, logic would dictate that Israel would ask, with its depletion of its air defense missiles that have not been resupplied at least in totality, with the configuration of or lack thereof right now of American forces in the Gulf, it would be logical for the Israelis to ask Trump to hold off. I would expect that would mean hold off until you can bring all of your assets into the region and get everything set up to then go to war with Iran for as long as it takes. But of course, you know, this would be the ultimate fantasy of Zionists, would be that the United States and Iran are finally locked into their, you know, the big one, the actual real war, not last year's mutual obliteration, but an actual war. So if there is any validity to these statements and reports that, you know, members of the Israeli establishment had asked Trump to stave off, it would only be to enable a better configuration of American forces. Now, with that said, again, Israel will be facing at least the same type of onslaught from Iranian missiles that it received during the 12-day war. So Again, it's impossible to tell, but it seems logical that the Israelis would have asked, hey, let's not like rush into this and let's make sure that we have all of our ducks in a row before getting into it. But that would not be requesting that, you know, the United States eventually does not go to war with Iran or does not, you know, begin bombing again, because ultimately that is what Netanyahu visited in Mar-a-Lago with Trump. This was just a few weeks ago. It was all about Iran. It was all about attempting to get Trump to start another war with Iran. And it wasn't this time based on, Netanyahu explicitly, it wasn't about Iran's nuclear program. Oh, you completely obliterated that, Trump. Now it was about Iran's ballistic missiles, which, yes. Oh, they're reconstituting their program. And as well, other reports that Iran's finally going to get those Su-35s by 2027. Therefore, we've got this like window, if you will, to do this. Netanyahu was already attempting to motivate Trump to take a hard line on Iran and to potentially go back to war with Iran. The protests in the bazaar that led to the opportunity for Mossad to, you know, bust out the Starlink and the guns and to really get things going propelled us to this moment where now the United States, it seems, needs to make its choice. Go to war with Iran in the next like minute to 2-3 weeks, or engage in the same type of BSing and shenanigans and charade and back off the imminent military strike, but to maintain all elements of the hybrid warfare against the Islamic Republic of Iran, which, to come full circle, we know bear on its stability. It bears on its security. This is a reality. So irrespective of whether the government can show hard evidence that these violent riots were supported and motivated from without, it doesn't change the fact of the price of the rial and people looking at their own lives or as some of my friends have explained, is just, you know, in tears that their kids, that their child's future, their education, with the economic circumstances the way that they are, it's just incredibly difficult on the population. So what I'm saying is the Iranian military strength and unity might stave off an imminent American military attack, but nevertheless, the Zionists and the Americans and the sanctions aren't going away. They're chomping at the bit to destroy the Islamic Republic, to break it up into as many constituent parts as possible. We're certainly not out of any woods. The question just is whether or not there will be a war. I whether I should add or not, I'll just say I'm even on the fence regarding that one. Not that I from the comfort of my like Zoom studio, you know, standing up to the Zionists and the American Empire, but as I have heard from so many Iranians and so many different statements and interviews over the last few years, but especially over the last week, the constantly being bullied, constantly being sanctioned, being okay, so Iranians aren't starving, but what about women who die because they don't have breast cancer meds that have been denied by the United States of America? At a certain point, and if anyone in the audience have had experience being bullied, I got bullied for being Iranian in junior high and for being overweight, so I know what it was like to get bullied by some super evil people. But at a certain point in the bullying, you get it's the end of it, and there's a certain empowered feeling when you realize that you're not going to take the bullying anymore, and that you're going to stand up to this. You're finally going to take matters into your own hand, and this provides agency. Sometimes short-lived, and sometimes at the expense of one's own like circumstances and health, but the bullying of an entire society and the deprivation that sanctions and this maximum pressure regime has enabled isn't something that can also be sustained forever against a proud nation like Iran with its thousands of years of history. So I guess I'm just closing in saying I don't know whether tearing off the Band-Aid now wouldn't be favorable to waiting until the Zionists and Americans have their force, their favorable force configuration to then go ahead and engage in the violence that they're already planning to engage in. I don't believe that Iran will do a preemptive strike. I don't believe that's within the doctrine. That's not within the culture. That's not really within the effective playing cards that Iran has. But I just don't necessarily think that all members of the Iranian establishment are hoping that this one blows over this time, because this might be the time to go relative to what I said about Israeli defense, air defense strength, American configuration. This might actually be the time to go. So
interestingly, because I did hear Ali Zadeh recently, maybe was on Max Blumenthal's Gray Zone show or elsewhere. He's been on a few places, or even on his own Jadal English channel, where he said there are some people who analyze the situation and think that Iran made a strategic error in agreeing to end the 12-day war, but that in fact, actually it had the upper hand and it really perhaps needed to press the advantage when it had it. And then this is another kind of component of U.S. and perhaps, I'm not sure, Israeli, could they possibly be, fantasizing and self-deluding, you know, after what they experienced during the 12-day war over the summer, to think that Iran has been weakened. This is like the way in which, you know, this was framed, is like this is the chance because, you know, Iran is rebuilding its missiles and its air defenses, and we should do it now while it's been weakened, both, you know, itself militarily, economically, and so on, which, of course, economically, it has been. We can certainly say that. But also regionally, you know, that there's been rollbacks of, you know, Iran's allies and so on. And what you were saying about it's not in the culture. Well, we, of course, have become very used to understanding the strategic patience doctrine, really, of Iran, that, like, you know, its kind of perspective is a long term one, that if it can sustain itself through these periods of crises, it ultimately is going to develop and become strong. It's a nation of, you know, nearly 100 million. I mean, you know, it's a highly educated, you know, population. There's a lot of potential. It is obviously, you know, could be the regionally dominant country if it wasn't being, you know, suppressed by these unilateral sanctions and constantly being undermined and so forth. It has that as its long-term kind of sense, that it just needs to outlast this failing project of settler colonial imperial disruption that is based on a very small and highly dependent, you know, relationship with the imperial West that is itself, of course, also, you know, having its problems. So that's what we've come to be aware of as the general Iranian doctrine. But Ali Alizadeh said something interesting as well, is that if you turn the situation from that kind of a calculation into leaders of the Islamic Republic, the leaders of the IRGC, the people who are most dedicated to the Islamic Republic's, kind of continuance, if they feel that this is an existential threat, then their strategic calculations and subsequently tactics may change. And they may be, you know, if they feel that there is absolutely no way you can continue to negotiate and that there is no comparative advantage to the doctrine of strategic patience under these current circumstances, then they might have a very different calculation. And that's something that he was, you know, kind of putting out there, is that the miscalculation or the misperception that somehow Iran has actually been very substantially degraded in terms of its strategic capabilities, its military capacities, and so on, that that's actually a miscalculation, and it could be a very dangerous one if they put the leadership of the, you know, Islamic Republic in the position of feeling that it is facing an existential threat, right? So I'm wondering what you think about that as one of the contexts in which to think about going forward, you know, what we might see.
Well, I can't get into, obviously, Bibi Netanyahu's head, but with his desperation, both individually with his, you know, legal circumstances and then his concern for the Zionist project, I wouldn't put it past him. And this would be, in a way, like brilliant, kind of Dr. Evil level brilliant, but to foment a situation whereby Israel was getting pummeled so hard by Iran that the only option that could be presented logically at that point by Israel to Trump or from Israel would be, we got to use a tactical nuke. We thought we could handle them with conventionals, but oh my God, the Iranians have this huge arsenal that we didn't know about, and now we're getting pummeled. What are we going to do? I because Netanyahu is his back is against the wall. He's in the corner. It's just amazing that he's still standing as a politician. But he is still standing and is desperate to have his reputation solidified in the mantle of having defended and enabled Zionism to persist in the 21st century. He absolutely must foment a war against Iran. This is his destiny. And so relative to the conventional strength of the Iranian aerospace forces, certainly Iranian ground forces, we didn't even need to talk about that because nobody's even talking about invading. It just doesn't add up, and that's why I'm making this point. That Iran has the conventional capacity to completely destroy the U.S. military in the Persian Gulf and much of Israel's military and also industrial facilities. It maintains that capacity. It does not, as far as we know, maintain a nuclear weapons capacity. That, of course, is something that the United States and Israel maintain. And this would be based on some of the admonitions that I received from your audience the last time that I was confidently stating that they're not going to attack Iran again. You know, don't underestimate the batshit, pardon me, but insanity of Zionists and American imperialists. And so kind of jumping here in this framework, but just think about what Trump is doing. Think about what Trump is doing relative, if you will, on the global and domestic stage, relative to international law and the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The discussion for the last really two, three decades, even since the fall of the Soviet Union. Well, maybe we can use tactical nukes. Maybe we should. Maybe we should bust out a Mighty Mike. Come on. You know, under Hegseth, the Department of War, I'm just saying. So this is when I myself rethink my own mm-hmm. confident statements regarding, you know, the security of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the face of American and Israeli aggression, because this could also be designed to lead to a one-way nuclear exchange that would, I guess, in the hopes of the Zionists, then somehow bring an end to Iranian military strength and Iran as a threat to Zionist expansion. Nothing else has changed, Adnan. Nothing. But based on the three moving points of analysis that I was talking about last time, American soft and hard power relative to what you were explaining about Venezuela in the Middle East, much less than in June. Soft power, the world watching Americans getting shot in the face by, like, you know, a masked Gestapo and Trump's reaction. I'm just saying the American soft and hard power since our last conversation greatly diminished. I would say Israeli soft and hard power as well, still slipping downward. Iran, the idea was in the wake of these, you know, awesome riots that are going to weaken the republic and show everyone how much Iranians hate their government, this might have been an opportunity for some sort of exchange. I don't believe that. I think they were just wanting the Iranians to get the job done. I don't believe that this was supposed to culminate on like day seven with a Zionist and American military strike. But having failed, they go for plan B, which is, oh, I guess we should save the protesters or something. And then we start talking about the renewal of warfare. Unless they're planning on, or at least Beebe is planning in the back of his mind on this leading to a nuclear exchange, I'm just not seeing it again because it doesn't work out for the United States or Israel militarily.
Well, and some of that consciousness, you know, is, you know, despite the fact that the Trump administration seems to have adopted the neocon agenda, you know, of hook, line, and sinker here, that there are, you know, other forces even within the Republican Party that are not too keen on U.S. Imperial intervention in the U.S., you know, that is something that it seems that enough people have started to question, you know, across the spectrum of American public opinion, these like, you know, kind of costly and difficult and illegitimate wars abroad. And, you know, that might be one of the constraints, is that not only is there materially very little capacity with an overstretched declining empire, but also there is even less kind of ideological kind of compulsion, you know, with, or it's just not the, you know, I was complaining, have people not been paying attention since Iraq? You know, do they not remember? But it's really the sort of kind of liberal left that is dedicated to these kind of, you know, humanitarian interventions, who seem to be compelled or persuaded. But in fact, actually, a lot of people don't really have an interest in it in the same way, and don't kind of think of the United States as this kind of, you know, progressive power to shape a better world. Like, you know, that is no longer really, you know, at the forefront of people's ideological consciousness about the place of the United States in the world. I think too much has happened historically that even if you're not paying that much attention, it's just not as compelling and persuasive. You know, it's really, however, you know, interesting, you've been talking a little bit about, you know, the audience. I've noticed that there's quite a lot of new people, you know, in the comments, and, you know, with a range of views. And I've only had to ban, you know, one person for, you know, making, you know, explicit threats against my guest. But it's been interesting to watch. I've left those comments there because, you know, in some ways, this is what's happening, and it's good for people to see the, you know, kinds of views that, you know, some people are still, you know, perpetuating despite everything that we would hope history, recent events would teach us. And so, you know, I believe in, you know, open dialogue. So I've left a lot of those there, and people have been responding and reacting in this discussion. And I think that's been very healthy. But I hope that those who have come to troll and, you know, represent imperialist sorts of perspectives, sometimes out of, like, you know, sometimes they're bots, I'm sure. And we know that there's an massive, like, operation in social media that's taking place. There's a huge infrastructure of diasporic pro kind of, you know, Shah, or at least anti-Islamic Republic media out there. This is a huge industry as well. But if you've come, perhaps you've maybe heard at least some analysis and facts that will give you a different perspective. And you're always welcome to come back, because perhaps you might agree, at least, you know, that Palestinians deserve freedom, Venezuelans should have their sovereignty, and maybe then you can start to apply a similar sort of logic to other, you know, theaters of the world. This is, I think, what it really boils down to, is do we respect the principle of sovereignty, you know, in the world? And, you know, it's hard and very difficult, it seems, for even the Western left to give up on the kind of hegemonic and, you know, post-colonial ideas of supremacist, you know, that the perspective and the ideas, you know, that we have in the West need to be imposed upon the rest of the world, rather than allowing people to have sovereignty. If they're going to make change, they will make it, you know, in their own sort of way, there is legitimate grievances that people have because of the economic situation. That has to be understood, of course, within the larger structural perspective of U.S. illegal unilateral sanctions upon Iran. In any case, I've really enjoyed very much this conversation with you, Dave, and I think many people in the audience really appreciate and have benefited from the very sober, analysis, the facts, and also even, I don't do a lot of the kind of like military stuff, but I know you keep up a lot more on this kind of strategic and military things, and it's been very useful and helpful for us to have that perspective. So before people leave the stream, I just want to say, you can still like it and share it and people can watch it back. I want to thank everybody who's been coming to these consistently. It's really wonderful to come back. It's been a little over a month since we've had these office hours. We'll be getting them back in a regular sort of fashion with great guests like Dave Yagubian, scholars, historians, academics, activists, analysts, journalists, and people like that, and always come back and post your questions. We really appreciate the community that we've developed here. I'm sorry that it's been so long since we've had one of these, but we will be more regular again. So I want to thank you all again, and thank Dave. It's been great to have you back on.
Thank you.
And peace and solidarity to you all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم